This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
A silent storm begins to brew in an ancient land of darkness. With tumultuous force from the crust of the earth, two worlds come together as one, from the past and the present, celebrating culture and spirit, paving the pathway to our future. It's time for dreaming. Urban dreaming. Finding your voice. Finding your spirit. Joy 94.9. Wawinjeka, Joy 94.9 would like to acknowledge and pay respect to the sovereign peoples of the past, present and future generations of the Kulin Nations on whose unceded land we work, live and broadcast from. We would also like to acknowledge all our brother boys and sister girls of the LGBTI communities.
Yes, hello, you're in Urban Dreaming. Joy 94.9, this is Sarami on the mic.
Hey, it's Maddie here.
And it's Claire Bear in the corner.
Yes, a special guest tonight. Unfortunately, we can't have Miss Elania because she's feeling sick. Wow. As well as Chris Tate. He's a busy boy, so we just got to make do without them. But, you know, I'm really happy to have you guys on board. So, and it's good to have you back, Maddie.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad to be back. It's Radiothon. Who wouldn't be glad to be back at Radiothon?
Exactly. And I wonder if anyone's won that car yet. We need to make sure we get the word out, because it's really important that you guys know that if you get your membership or you renew your membership, it means you get a chance to win a flash car.
Yeah, a Holden Astra or something for the Moto Grand GP next year as well. So that's renewing your membership, which is really cool. Otherwise, also they can donate, can't they? Every $10 will get you an entry into a prize to win a cruise to New Caledonia. Very swish.
Nice. So you got up to the June the 30th, if you want to get down and boogie with the Joy 94.9. So I'm a little bit sick at the moment. I've got a bit of hay fever, and I've just thrown myself on the panel. It's been like a whole year. So if I have any spaces, just know that I'm getting back into practice, and I've got my old mate Jason here on the side of me, just in case. So say hello, Jace.
Hey, Siri, how you going?
You probably need your mic on.
Hello.
Yes, he's on.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, cool. So just so you know, guys, we've got a really deadly show tonight. We're going to be speaking to a couple of amazing people. One is Anita Heiss, who's an author, a really prolific Aboriginal author, actually. And she's recently just done her latest book, which is called Barbed Wire and Cherry Blossom. So we'll be having a chat with her. And also we'll be yarning up with a fellow named Bernard Namok. And this is Bernard Namok, who's junior of senior. And when I mention junior and senior, I mean that because we don't want to cross the wires. But Bernard Namok is actually known for the man who designed the Torres Strait flag. And so he'll be having a yarn. His son will be having a yarn with us. And it's the 25th anniversary for the flag, which is really cool.
And it's a beautiful flag too. You know, the greens and the blues and the black and the white, it's a very vibrant, it's an incredible flag. So I'm really excited about learning about the history and the creation of that. So you guys need to stick along for that.
Yeah. And I think, if anything, we must reintroduce Claire, because Claire's been here once before and her voice was like, a yes, a hello and a goodbye. And we need to know more about you.
And then I spoke a little bit more when Davey and Jacob were on. Am I? Yeah. Yeah. So what kind of information would you particularly like from me, Suri?
Just yarn about what you do.
Well, I'm a writer and a theatre maker. I'm also an academic. I deal with the history of war and the history of fascism. So I'm quite interested in a few of the topics that are coming on today.
I have a question for you, Claire.
Yes, Jason.
How many Claires do you know that are also Claire Bears? There'd be a few,
all of them,
there?
Without exception. It is the easiest rhyme. I think they're all very different bears, though.
Yeah.
Yes.
What kind of bear are you, Claire?
I'm a grizzly.
Yeah. She knows that.
Yeah. So most importantly, I have these incredibly long black claws. They're usually for holding books. So I'm quite excited about Anita being on, because one of my friends who moved to Sydney from Perth about 10 years ago, she introduced me to Anita Heiss's books, and she really enjoyed them. And I'm looking forward to asking Anita a few questions via my friend, the giant fan.
Good. Well, and that's really exciting because I don't know all that much about Anita Heiss's books, but I've been doing some research this afternoon and I'm super duper excited. I'm fangirling without even having read a single line. So I'm really excited.
Fangirling is the best part of fanning, can I just be clear?
Yeah. It definitely is. So what do you do here? What kind of theatre have you done? Where could we have seen it?
I've done two fringe shows in Perth, both of them about... dating and the kinds of jokes that women tell each other when there are no men around. I have a few if you want them. And here I am actually doing a play about how democracy dies and fascism rises. It's in the form of a Sherlock Holmes pastiche, which is good fun to work with.
And it's really interesting too because she's written a character as in a female character playing William Cooper and his petition.
There's a more precise way of saying that, though, so I'm trying to think that up at the moment. She is, because most of the characters in Conan Doyle, especially the story that I'm adapting, the Scandal in Bohemia, are male, but we have an all-female cast, we have turned Irene Adler into a representation of William Cooper and the work he did around protesting fascism. So, yes.
Yeah,
correct.
And that's yet to happen. I think in September they're planning on playing that. So
August and September, yes.
Yeah, can't wait for that.
I'm so sorry for the world today, with all the killing and all the hate. I get down on my knees and pray that it's not too late. That it's not too late for peace. And it's not too late for love, for all the children. To wake in fright and to hold them in your arms, tell them all it'll be alright, keep them safe from harm. And we hope, as we always wait to see the snow white dove for all the children everywhere. I ask the old ones up above, won't you hear this prayer? It's not too late to turn it round. We gotta find some common ground. I know it's there. Not today.
So I've got a very special guest on the line right now. This is Bernard Namok. But before we play, before we have a chat with him, I want to just quickly play what this segment is about.
Martha told me, he said, you have to carry your dad's name. It's a really important name up here in the Torres Strait.
The Torres Strait flag is in the front. Your file is designed in the front always when the procession comes through.
I've been told I'm like him, but I want to know what kind of person he was. Kind of rediscovering who I am, where I'm from.
Boat here, fish there.
That was a day to remember, the wedding day. I was the best man.
Look, my wedding dress. Memory will last long. Something stay with you.
Continue on where Dad left off.
Yes, and that was a beautiful intro to what this next segment is about. And we have on the line right now with us Bernard Namok Jr. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, man. I just want to do a quick intro to who your father was before we begin this conversation. So for those who don't know, Bernard Namok Sr. is the monument... basically monumental man who actually is the creator of the Torres Strait Islander flag. And he did this amazing thing for our people, for the people of the Torres Strait at Thursday Island. And this is now the 25th anniversary for the flag, and it's a very important time of the year. Unfortunately, Bernard Sr. passed away, but we have, obviously, in his shadows and doing an amazing job. That's his son right now. That's Bernard Jr., and he's online. How are you? What's happening?
I'm good. Not much. How are you?
Good, good. So in regards to what you do, for those who don't know, you've done a bit of, I guess you've studied heaps. And you went to, you've done your advanced diploma in communications. And it looks like you've done a bit of radio broadcasting as well.
And
you went over to Maningrida in West Arnhem Land to do your work as a radio broadcaster. And since then, you've just been, I guess, working really strongly towards your father's work, yeah?
Yeah. It's kind of like a six-year journey, you know. I've always wanted to tell that story and also, I guess, to educate people that don't know about the Torres Strait flag and also about the symbol of that flag and also what the colours represent, because, you know, it's little has been said and seen, you know, in media and when, you know, all our famous Indigenous players, you know, when they go represent Australia on the international sporting stage and, you know, they carry both flags and, you know, people question about that flag and kind of raise conversation about, you know, the Torres Strait flag. And I guess, you know, it was a good time to kind of educate people, and it was always my thing to tell that story before the 25th anniversary, which is next Monday.
Yeah, so just on that, with the education of the flag and the colours, it's this beautiful, vibrant, coloured flag, the blues, the greens, the white and the black, obviously. Can you let us know what does the flag actually represent? What do each of those colours mean?
Well, the two green represent mainland Australia, the bottom green, and the top green represents Papua New Guinea. The blue is the waters between the two continents, so the waters of the Torres Strait. The black, obviously, you know, Indigenous people. The dari, which is the Torres Strait headdress, Dad went with the simple headdress because, you know, kind of like a basic headdress that represent all Torres Strait Islanders. Different island groups have different meaning when they put the headdress on, but Dad went with the simple one, basic one, that represent the whole of the Torres Strait people. And also the five star is the five cluster groups up there in the Torres Strait. So the central, eastern, western, top western, and Port Kennedy, as well as many that, you know, made the mainland their home. So the five pointed star represent those five island cluster groups, as well as the star when our forefathers used the waters. Compass wasn't invented back in the early days, so they looked at the stars and traveled the waters to get to their destination.
Yeah, right. See, that's a really beautiful symbol, I guess, on the flag, and it's equally so with our Aboriginal flag, with the red, black, and the yellow. It's really great that you're able to explain that to people. Of course, we see it all the time: the Australian flag, the Torres Strait Islander, and the Aboriginal flag. But not a lot of people know what it's about. Hey, how many scrap ideas did your dad have before he came up with that one?
I think he had a few, probably about five or six. I was about 7 years old when Dad did all the sketches. He used to transform, you know, the dinner table into his desk. And me and my little sister, she was about 6 years old. We never allowed to go near Dad when he was sitting down doing all the sketches. And so all the sketches Dad did, but whenever Dad did the sketches, he went to his father-in-law. He was part of the 1967 referendum. So he asked my granddad, you know, advice on what's best to put down that represent the whole Torres Strait. So he would get advice from my granddad to do all the sketches for the flag. And there was a few flags designed that Dad did, but the committee back then in 91, Island Cornering Council, they chose that flag design as a national flag, simple, and it represented everyone up there.
And was your dad an artist? Is that what he did, or was it one of those kind of like a competition? Give us a flag design, and we might take it.
Well, Dad did all the sketches. He did. It was a hobby for Dad. So it was basically just out of interest, you know, when he got slack, you know. Mum used to say there was nothing on TV, like any documentaries. Dad would borrow my colouring pencils and scrapbook and just would sit down and draw. He used to draw, like, all the T-shirts for the festivals up there in the Torres Strait. He used to do little design T-shirts for all the festivals and sporting T-shirts and all that stuff, yeah.
It's really interesting too, because it wasn't until after, I guess, 22 years later, it wasn't recognised. It was recognised, sorry, but that was that was the idea of the Australian government by granting it. It wasn't until, what was it? What year was that? 1995?
Yeah, 95 it was represented. Like, you know, it was represented as like the official flag of Australia. But, yeah, it was first launched up on the island back in 1992, in 1993, Dad passed away, so he didn't really get to see much of that flag, how far and wide, you know, that flag has flown. But he kind of lived a short life here. And then, you know, the flag went on to become a national flag in 95, and kind of see it everywhere now, eh?
Oh, man, it's just amazing. And I see that you guys, well, the documentary is showing on NITV. Was that tonight?
The documentary will be on NITV on the 29th of May.
The
25th anniversary, yeah.
Excellent.
At 8:30.
So yeah. make sure you guys tune into that, because that's something definitely worthwhile to check out. And, yeah, unfortunately we've run out of time with you, Bernard, but thank you so much for, you know, making time for us. And yeah, good on you for doing, you know, your father proud. I think it's awesome.
No worries, and I look forward to heading back home on the weekend to show it back to families and back to Cairns. And hoping that, you know, everybody will see the documentary on NITV.
I'm sure they will, because this is what we're here for, to get the word out for you.
Yeah, no worries.
All right, look after yourself, and we'll chat soon.
No worries. See ya.
See ya. So that was Bernard Nemoc, Jr.
What a great man. What a great story, a great legacy from his dad. you know, to have that and to have the documentary on NITV is awesome.
Too deadly. All right, guys, so we're going to play another song for you. This is Electric Fields, and the song is Inmar, traditional. Let's go.
That would be the grandmothers and the grandfathers being like, oh, you guys got to get up and dance, okay? Now we got to do the traditional dance. And if we didn't get it right, our grandmothers and grandfathers would be like, oh, aladji, meaning you got to do it like this. You got to do it like this. And when you'd hear, eh, that's when you knew they would be very proud of what you did.
Hi, this is Alfie Akuri. You're listening to Urban Dreaming on Joy.
Yes, you're back on Urban Dreaming. This is Sarami on the mic.
Hey, and this is Maddie.
And Claire Bear in the corner.
My special guest. Okay, guys, so we just had the deadly song from Electric Fields.
And that was Inmar.
Inmar. Now, I know you're a big fan of Electric Fields, and we just had a chat with them last week, didn't we?
Oh, mate, I'm such a big fan. Since listening to them last week, they are the deadliest, like they're my favourite. I've had them playing on repeat since last week.
All right, guys, so we have another special guest on the line right now with us. And before we begin, though, I'd like to acknowledge the country in which we stand and the Kulin Nations, and of course, making special announcement for the Wurundjeri and land of which we stand on. And Anita Heiss is our special guest, and before we have a chat, we just want to let you know a bit more about her. So she is an author of non-fiction as well as fiction, historical fiction, that is, commercial women's fiction, poetry, social commentary, and travel articles. She's a regular guest at the Writers' Festivals and travels internationally performing her work and lecturing on Indigenous literature. So she is a lifetime ambassador of the Indigenous Literacy Foundation and a proud member of the Wiradjuri Nation of Central New South Wales. And right now we have her on the line. Hello, Anita.
Oh, good evening. I'm very excited. I'm sitting here in my nightie, I must say, in my bed in on Gadigal country in Sydney. It's opening night of the Sydney Writers' Festival, so I've ducked out of the party just so I could yarn with you, Mob.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you for this.
Yeah.
Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Oops, someone pressed a button. So we hear you went to New York just recently. Can you let us know a bit more about that?
Yeah, I actually, just as an observer, I went to the 16th session of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous issues. I'd always wanted to attend for many years. Many of my peers had been, and I wanted to go just to see the process of what happened, and it was the 10th anniversary this year of the Declaration on Indigenous Rights, since that was actually implemented back in 2007. So there was a celebration around that. Of course, back then in 2007, Australia was one of four nations that did not actually sign the Declaration. 143 nations did, and we were one of four who didn't. And so it was interesting to be there just to see how that all unfolded, and it was a really interesting space to be in.
It's really interesting times, isn't it?
It is.
Just so you know, we've got two guests in the studio with us as well. So in case you hear another a voice out of nowhere, it's these other two with me. So that's Maddie and Claire.
Hello, Anita.
Hi,
I'm
Maddie.
Claire.
Hello.
Hello, Anita.
I feel like I'm at a job interview.
you kind of are. I've been doing some research on you today, and I was saying to these guys earlier that I've been fangirling over you a bit this afternoon. Yeah, I just love your... so intelligent, but also so witty. I was watching a bit of your show reel and a little bit of your TED talks and bits and pieces. And I'm just really excited to have you on air. My mob is Wiradjuri people as well, so I was well, actually from out Brungle way, near your guys.
Well, my family's from Brungle.
You might be family. Look out.
You might be related.
Oh, we must be. He's good looking.
Yes, good absolutely.
Looking. Yes. He doesn't have a face for radio. Let's just say that.
But we all know that problem when we go out and we go we're related to all the good looking people. It's interesting. I met someone years ago, and I was at my cousin's 21st. Sorry, in Tumut, which is obviously
close to Brungle. You go to the Star? Was it at the Star Hotel?
I don't know that I was legal at the time.
Oh, right, okay.
let's pretend that I didn't. And anyway, and I was looking, the 21st was in the town hall, I think it was, and I remember looking across, you know, a smoke-filled room. This is back in the 80s, and I've got, oh, he's good-looking, and he turned around and was like my first cousin.
Yeah.
Not looking anymore.
It's always the way, isn't it?
That's my curse. It's your curse too. It's our. It's the thing, isn't it?
And we're so lucky that you guys are prepared to take that curse on and just walk around and look fabulous and then talk about it with immense modesty. It's beautiful to see.
Listen, sister, humility is overrated.
That's what I say. You've got to express yourself, brag about it. If you got it, flaunt it.
So Claire's saying that from a white perspective, by the way, because she is a Gadigal.
Oh, my goodness me.
Modula.
Am I ever?
Modula.
But I work a lot with Siri and all the beautiful families that work in Indigenous art, and it is, yeah. I'm laughing way too hard right now, Anita.
Exactly. That's awesome. Oh, I didn't know this was going to be so much fun. There I was at the party. I've got to go. I've got to quick get your spring roll. I've got to get back to the room. I've got to do this.
And now you can go back and just say you had a much better time with three people from Melbourne.
She had a much better time.
Oh, are you
a
using...
A much better time.
Okay.
I don't even know what to do with that, but keep going.
You know, let us know about, because I know you're at the festival at the moment, so yeah, what's happening there?
Well, can I tell you about, we've got this fantastic thing happening tomorrow night for anybody, particularly any of your listeners that are in Sydney. I am a lifetime ambassador for the Indigenous Literacy Foundation, and I also manage the Epic Good Foundation, and so Epic Good is a partner with the ILF. And last year we had our inaugural Kick On for Literacy event, which celebrates Reconciliation Week, plus Sir Doug Nicholls Round, which is you mobber in Melbourne. So, you know all about the AFL. So, reconciliation round for the AFL. And also wanting to raise money for the Indigenous Literacy Foundation so we can get books into the hands of some of our most disadvantaged Australians who are Indigenous kids in remote communities. So last year we had it in Brisbane. The Epic Good has a partnership with the Hawthorn Football Club, and so we go where Hawthorn are playing. And then this year Hawthorn are playing Swans on Friday night, and I was already a guest for the Sydney Writers Festival, so I rang up and I said, look, I'd really like to do this fundraiser and I want to do a debate. I've always wanted to have a fun but public conversation around sports versus the arts. And so we're doing this debate tomorrow night, and it's The Book is Better Than the Ball. So you'll probably know of Shelley Ware.
Shelley who? Shelley Ware?
Oh, yes, yeah.
yeah.
Yes, we know Shelley.
Yeah, so Shelley and David Lawrence, who wrote the Fox Swift books with Cyril Rioli, they are arguing for The Book, although they're mad AFL fans, and myself as an author, and Graeme Simpson, who's the author of The Rosie Project, we're arguing for The Ball. And so it's all funny, it's all lighthearted, but we all want to win. And at the end of the day, we've got raffle prizes, I've got people who have donated beautiful, Brenda Croft has donated an amazing piece of artwork for auction, and another friend of mine who's an author has donated 3 days away at this fantastic holiday house, the Beach Jarowa. We've got a Hawthorn signed Guernseys. We've got a reconciliation around Guernsey. We've got David Williams from Galimba has painted footy boots in the Swans colours. So at the end of the day, we're doing it all for fun, but it's about raising cash for the ILF. So I'm very, very, very excited about that. I've spent 5 months organising it. And apart from that, I'm doing some school days talking about my new book that's just come out. And on Saturday night, doing something at the Sydney Town Hall, and the theme is It's Nasty Women, and it's based on, it's a reaction to Donald Trump when he called Hillary Clinton a nasty woman. So I'm going to talk about, and nasty women, of course, are those women who are doing their jobs and you know.
And doing it competently.
Doing it constantly, facing challenges and, you know, breaking down barriers and leading the way, particularly for other women. So I'm going to talk about Barangaroo, who has been a long second wife, because most of the people in Sydney will have heard of Barangaroo but probably don't know her story. So I'm going to talk about her. And I'm going to talk about Oojaroo, who obviously wrote the Charter for Aboriginal Rights and was the first Aboriginal person to publish a collection of poetry in 1964.
Love Oojaroo's poems. I just read some of them on the weekend, actually. So
she's my probably number one inspiration in terms of being a writer.
Yes, very powerful.
And the third person I'm going to talk about is a woman who, a very dear friend of mine, who we just laid to rest the other day, and her name is Rosie Scott, and she and I worked on the NT Intervention Anthology together, and she was a huge advocate for the rights of asylum seekers as well, and set up Women for WIC to keep the government in check in terms of the anti-intervention. So I'm going to talk about those three women who were nasty women before their time.
Wow.
I'm taking notes madly of all those names.
Great.
I like to collect nasty women. Well, especially for inspiration, you need to be able to. And also who inspired them always intrigues me. Who were the mentors for them going back, because we all come out of traditions that need to be acknowledged as well.
It's interesting though. Like, I never thought about that. I mean, I know obviously Rosie and would have had people that she has as a mentor. She was a mentor, but there's probably, you know, people that she looked up to. But if you think back to the day of Barangaroo and she refused to, you know, cover herself up to dine with the governor and so forth, and she stopped when she saw, you know, white fellas being flogged for whatever they'd done. Like, she stepped in and said, this is not the right thing to do. You know, who would her... I wonder who her mentors were.
Yes.
You know, so the old women who went before her.
Yes.
But we'd never know, because obviously that's not documented.
So. No. But that's the best thing about being a writer, isn't it, that we can actually ask that question, and then you get to speculate that on that in each book that you write.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, and that's one of the reasons I write fiction too, because it allows you a little bit of space to imagine what might have been possible.
Yes.
So work around working with facts, but what could have been possible, or what do we imagine may have been?
But Anita, you work with both fact and fiction. Do you alternate, or do you write alongside each other so that they inform, your fiction to your non-fiction and back again?
I don't actually have, in terms of books published, nearly everything is fiction.
Yes.
I have a memoir called Am I Black Enough for You, and that's around identity.
Yes.
And I have, my first book was called Sacred Cows, and that was really just a satirical look at Australian culture.
Mm.
But my fiction, so whether it's, for instance, my most recent two novels, so last year I released a novel called Barbed Wire and Cherry Blossoms,
yes.
and it was about the Cowra breakout.
Yes.
And that really, I created a fictional story about two characters who fall in love to drive the story. So it's an Aboriginal girl on a Rambie mission where my mum
yes.
grew up, and a Japanese POW. Now, all those Japanese prisoners of war, for your listeners, who escaped on August 5, 1944, they were all recaptured or died.
Yes.
But for the purpose of my story, I had to have one that escaped. So that part is fictional, but everything around what happened in the breakout, life in the compound, life on the reserve, living on the station, living under the Act of Protection, all that was based on historical fact. So
yes.
recorded information that I'd got, through the PO, through the Cowra Breakout Association, through newspapers and so forth, and from my mother's own memories of growing up on a Rambie during that time. And then I created characters, to tell the story that was factual. So
yes.
And so you're actually introducing the Aboriginal character, who's Banjo Williams.
Yes.
And he basically discovers Hiroshi, yeah? Who is the actual soldier.
Have you read this book?
Yeah, I've read it. I read it yesterday. Joking. No, I just did a bit of my research as well. And I see that, yeah, he's one of the soldiers.
I was impressed there for a minute.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I actually, when it's something that interests me, then I'll read it for sure.
Yeah.
And I find this really interesting, so it's great. I'm definitely going to check it out. But the idea of one soldier... who was a Japanese soldier who manages to escape and to be, I guess, introduced to an Aboriginal family on the mission.
Yep.
So, yeah.
So the idea was, can I tell you where the story came from to start with?
Sure. Please do.
Romeo and Juliet, okay. Two star-crossed lovers.
Well, I'm a hopeless romantic, so there was always going to be a love story in there. But I just keep writing the love story, still happens to me. Yeah, you get the violin.
No. We can have a talk about that at the end. You can give us a 1 minute précis of what you're looking for.
Better than the opening night party of the city, right? I shouldn't say that. because nobody at the festival is listening to this because they're all at the party. But no. I wish you do this every week.
Yeah. My notebook is full of information on you. We probably could do this every week.
Okay. I was at Pearl Harbor yes. and I'd been there before, and for this particular time I was really conscious of most of the tourists there were Japanese, and they're watching and being part of a very American version of what happened at Pearl Harbor and the bombing of Pearl Harbor by the Japanese. And I'm watching and I'm thinking, and they're all very calm, I think, oh, God, I wonder what they must think. I wonder if this is the story, the way that they have been told the same story, because
yes.
it's a shared story. And it made me, and I was just really surprised how calm they were, because if there was a level of propaganda to it, because obviously it is what it is. It was very, as I say, very American version of that moment in time. And anyway, it made me think about Cowra and the Cowra breakout and World War II, and how everything I'd ever heard about the Cowra breakout or read or seen, because there was a two-part doco, telemovie, none of it ever mentioned that 4.5 or 4.6 miles in a direct line from that POW camp was another camp
mm-hmm.
where the blackfellas lived with less rights than prisoners of war. So the prisoners of war in the POW camp were treated as they should have been to the letter of the law under the Geneva Convention. The Japanese prisoners ate fish and rice. They ate the diet that they would have had back home. Many of them put on weight when they were in that camp because they'd come from, a lot of them from New Guinea, where their own government had not sent them food, and they spent half the time fighting for food during that war. And they had their own hospital in that camp. Whereas blackfellas in Cowra were in a town where the hospital was segregated, the cinema was segregated, and they lived on a mission where people were living on rations. They were dealt their rations out of the old horse stables. Mum said there was one tap out the front of her, out of front of their hut, where they would get all their water and they had to boil up to cook and so forth to make tea. The kids went to the mission school.
So Anita, at the moment, if we put this story into 2017 and we were, say, in a part of Australia that was very close to maybe Manus and Nauru, would we be talking about a series of camps for people that are separated by a few decades but are effectively politically being controlled in the same way? Are we talking about history repeating?
I would say we are. It is worse,
yes,
than what it was then. And it's a really good question. And it's interesting because when I wrote this book, I didn't think about things like that.
Yes,
obviously I've participated in the politics and activism around the appalling treatment of asylum seekers in this country and refugees over like a decade of years and years and years. But when the first interview I did for Barbed Wire and Cherry Blossoms last year was a young journo from WA who had a grandparent who'd been a POW.
Yes.
And she asked this question. She said, what have we learned? What is different today from what happened to blackfellas and also the POWs to what's happening in Manus Island?
Yes.
And I thought, oh, my God, gone backwards. We have learned nothing.
We've become more lethal, and I come from Western Australia, and I know that we are we're even more lethal just on a basic level to our everyday citizens all over the state. Anita, I'm getting the winding up. Yes, but can we talk about this again? Because this is exactly my area of interest.
Anita, thank you so much. Unfortunately, we have run out of time, and I just really want to say we appreciate your time that you've given us, and
thank
we will definitely be in touch. And for those who didn't know, that book, again, we must mention it because it's her latest book. That's Anita Heiss's book, and it's called Barbed Wire and Cherry Blossoms. Definitely
thank
something
you.
To read. And I think in regards to what you're doing in your work is bloody amazing. I think it's continue doing what you do. Of course you will. And to also mention that I did have one question. I was wondering whether you were thinking about making some of your work into plays.
I would love. I need somebody else to do that for me. So if anyone's listening and they're playwrights,
we are listening.
Claire Bear's a writer.
Yes, Claire Bear's a writer, and we're
an actor.
Yeah, there's an actor. There's a couple of actors in the studio. Plus,
get
of course,
your people to talk to my people.
Entrepreneurs.
On a production thing. But quickly, really quickly, there's tickets still for Kick On for Literacy tomorrow night at the Sydney Writers Festival.
Yes.
So come along and have a great time.
Oh,
thank you so much. And once again, Anita Heiss. That was Anita Heiss, guys. An amazing, prolific Aboriginal writer of fiction and non-fiction.
Thank you, Anita.
Thank you, Anita.
Thank you.
Take
Have
care.
A great party.
Hi, this is Alfie Akuri. You're listening to Urban Dreaming on Joy.
Yes, you're on Joy 94.9. This is Sarami.
Hey, this is Maddie.
And it's Claire Bear in the corner.
It's almost time up, but before we do take off, I just want to have a quick chat about Anita. It's pretty interesting, like the work she's doing, of course. But I reflected back onto Black Diggers. And Black Diggers was written back... I'm trying to think, what year was that written?
I'm going to refer to Matt on this.
Well, according to 2015, it wasn't written that long ago.
So. No, in regards to the actual, back in the times, I meant, like, when was it actually?
Oh, when was it set?
It was set, sorry, is what I meant to say. I'm pretty tired at the moment, my apologies.
Matt and I are pointing at each other because we're trying to work out who's going to do the talking. Okay, so it's First World War or Second World War for Black Diggers?
I think it was the second, wasn't it?
Second.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Because the reason why I brought it up is because the similarities in regards to, you know, what happened in her story about the cherry blossoms and in regards to, you know, because I come from Broome, and Broome is really renowned for the Japanese bombing as well. And we tend to, I guess, have a bias in regards to our mob, and we always think, you know, the people who obviously did the damage to our country and our town was the Japanese. But, you know, fast-forwarding it, you realise you've created, I guess you've discovered and you've created some many relationships with these people. And I personally, I love the Japanese culture. And, you know, it's hard because there's a lot of our mob who are holding on to past, you know, stuff that obviously affected them. But for us mob who were, you know, I guess weren't in those times, and to reflect back on that and to see the you know, obviously the hurt that our mob went through, but then seeing the joy that what can be brought to our communities as well. And I had a moment of thinking Black Diggers as well in regards to, I guess, a story that reflected. Mm-hmm. And because Matt's actually currently working on Black Diggers. And Matt, let us know, I guess, the relationship, because I know you're nodding your head as well as we speak about this.
Yeah. So Black Diggers is an incredible play that was written by Tom Wright, and basically tells the untold stories of the Indigenous diggers that sort of went to war, and the idea of colour only being skin deep, and when you're in the field together, your brothers in arms, we all bleed the same blood, and then what happened when we stepped back onto the soils of Australia after fighting for this country, you know, the injustices that came with that. And also what I find really interesting is the fact that a lot of these Indigenous men wanted to fight for their country, to have a place in this country. And what happened was that they had to change their names in order to be able to get conscripted. And so when they came back from fighting for their country, they weren't given the same rights or the same let's call them gifts, bits of land or whatever was entitled to the diggers, because their actual names were different to what they had signed up on.
Yes. And of course, as a war historian and someone who identifies as a woman in war history, academia, the second question I have is, how many in the cast of Black Diggers are women at war?
Yeah, well, that's...
None.
There isn't any. But
is there
enough,
a female cast member?
Funny enough, there is.
There isn't in the original. Yes. It was 9 Indigenous men. However, yes, there is a character of Mum. And yes, in our cast, we do have a wonderful Indigenous woman playing that role, and some of the roles of men as well.
Excellent, excellent. Because did they have Indigenous nurses? Do you know if they're... In your research, have you come across Indigenous women?
I haven't come across that yet, but you might know.
Well, these are the things that you have to investigate as a writer and as a historian. Yeah, and those stories are just the start of the stories that we're yet to discover that have been hidden by dominant narratives when it comes to saying that there is only one type of Australian soldier. There's only one type of person who went to war. And most importantly, all the men and women who came back from war came back with PTSD and shock and things like that. And they were dealt with by their families, untrained and unsupported. And there's a huge amount of trauma there also that needs to be acknowledged, that you can't expect family units to look after wounded warriors, no matter when they came home.
Oh, absolutely. And look, it's a really exciting time as an Indigenous actor or in any sort of minority group, because our words are being heard now more than ever. And especially that's what a lot of Dr. Anita Heiss's stuff is about as well, is about the untold stories of the voices of our people.
Well, looks like we have to wrap it up, guys. Unfortunately, the hour is gone and no more. Finished. Kaput.
There is no more time.
Yeah, it's a shame because I know we want to just yarn more, but, you know, it's always good to make sure you tune in next week with us. And this is Urban Dreaming, of course, and stay tuned, guys. We're going to coming up next is a triple bypass, of course, and these guys, I'm sure they'll give you another deadly hour. So until then, we're going to say goodbye and all the best and saying...
Yeah, see you later, guys. I reckon I'll see you next week.
Oh, I might just be here.
And from my country, we say Galiao Mabu, so... That means hello and goodbye, actually. So a bit of Nyingma language for you for the day. All right, all the best. And thank you for tuning in.
Night
Dreamers. Urban Dreaming 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.